Consumer Focus with Martin Newman.
Hi there, welcome to Consumer Focus. My name is Martin Newman and this is my podcast. I'm going to bring you expert advice and opinion on retail, customer service and the British high street. I've worked in retail or service retail for over 35 years and I'm dedicated to championing the consumer and helping businesses to develop the best strategies for their customers. Today, I have the privilege of being joined by Alex White, who is an expert in international and British economics and politics. He was previously the chief political analyst at JP Morgan and director of research at the Economist's Intelligence Unit. Also, previously head of investment banking at the HM Treasury. So I think Alex is going to know a thing or two about today's subject. In his role as partner at Flink Global, he provides expert insight into the ways in which Brexit will affect imports and exports in the UK. So I know we've all heard a lot about Brexit recently, but couldn't really do a podcast at this moment in time and sadly not address it and maybe have a think about what the implications of that might be for the retail and other consumer sectors in the UK. So Alex, tell me, what do you think will be the biggest challenge for British businesses in the wake of a potential no-deal Brexit?
A no-deal Brexit takes us into a world that none of us understand. And frankly, it would be remiss of me to sit here and say, look, Martin, XYZ is going to happen after a no-deal. These are going to be the implications and this is how it's going to flow through. We simply don't know what that environment looks like. The reason that we don't know what that environment looks like is that it is, frankly, almost unprecedented in the modern world for an individual country to elect to cut itself off from its primary trading partners. We're ignoring the concept of economic geography. We're ignoring all of the prescriptions about the need for free trade that are particularly important for a small open economy, which is what the UK is.
Yeah.
So we are, I mean, the cliff analogy is overdone, but we really are standing at the edge of it. We can't see what's at the bottom of it. We can't see how big the cliff is. So it would be, I can't sit here and say in this scenario, sure, these are the things that would happen.
So although we can't give it a kind of black and white response with any assurance of exactly what will happen, I think we can probably hypothesise. Would it be fair to say that in the event of a no-deal Brexit, in all likelihood from a supply chain perspective, the flow of fresh produce, for example, into the United Kingdom will start to dry up? And, you know, I mean, I was told by someone else that after, I think, 5 or 6 days, basically you won't be able to buy any fresh goods in your local supermarket. You know, your fresh veg and fruit and everything will essentially have slowed down to a minimum.
Yeah, I mean, in a no-deal Brexit, effectively all bets are off in terms of supply chains. It's worth saying, though, that this is not some conceptual thing that may or may not happen at the 29th of March. Supply chains have lead times, as you know. We're in a world now where we are, if you're importing from East Asia, it takes 40, 41 days for the boat to arrive. Mm. So we're already at a point now where, you know, sorry, I'm shifting away from fresh produce, but we're already at a point where businesses need to be thinking about supply chains, and if they load that boat in Shanghai, are they going to be able to get it through the docks at Southampton?
Absolutely. Do you have any idea whatsoever, honestly, with regards to what might happen? So let's imagine it is that, you know, cliff edge nightmare scenario in a no-deal Brexit, and that container ship turns up at the dock in Southampton with electrical goods or fashion or whatever it happens to be. What's going to happen? What's going to stop it coming in? Or what might the barriers be in the context of a no-deal Brexit?
Well, my personal view is that in the context of a no-deal Brexit, what the UK government will do is say, look, we are going to temporarily rescind various customs controls because we will need to do that to allow the continued free supply of goods into this country.
Yeah.
That's obviously not a long-term solution, number one. And number two, it's not something that will necessarily be reciprocated by our trading partners. Mm-hmm. So perhaps the better example that I should have given is one of a British exporter now thinking about whether they're ready to put stuff on the boat the other way.
The other way, yeah. I was going to say, I mean, Brexit does you know, the implications of Brexit, or do the implications of Brexit potentially, or the no deal Brexit, does that, from a geographical point of view, would we as the UK still be able to deal with China, for example? Is it more going to impact us in terms of the EU nations being able to get goods to us, or and vice versa, or does it have a global implication for retailers and other businesses?
Well, both. I mean, it has a global implication because since we've been members of the EU, trade and the negotiation of international free trade agreements is a European Union competency.
Yeah.
So this country does not have any trade negotiators, or it has a few that we've hired over the past few years.
Yeah.
But it's a European Union competency, which means two things. It means, one, the existing free trade arrangements, of which the UK is a part, are arrangements between third countries and the EU.
Mm-hmm.
And those would need to be replicated when the UK leaves. Now, the Department for International Trade has given a summary recently of their progress in rolling over some of these existing European EU FTAs.
Mm-hmm.
They have taken pleasure in announcing that we've rolled over, for example, the FTA with the Faroe Islands.
Mm-hmm. That's helpful.
Very helpful. It is actually material in terms of the fishing industry, but
true.
In terms of
very
most
true.
Of the rest of the economy, pretty small beer.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a very large number of these still to be addressed, negotiated and rolled over.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first problem, is the fact that you actually need to go and replicate these existing trade deals. The second problem, and this is in no way to cast aspersions on the quality of the officials that we have, and we have some very good officials, but the UK doesn't have a history, as I said, of negotiating trade deals recently because it's been an EU competence.
Yeah, sure.
So we simply don't have...
We haven't had to.
We don't have the team. We don't have the team to do this.
Yeah.
Finally, a third point. There's a point about negotiating leverage. So various of the Brexiteers have been complaining recently about the way that the EU has treated us in these negotiations over mm-hmm. Brexit over the past couple of years. Frankly, if you think that the EU has been tough, try negotiating with China,
mm-hmm.
try negotiating with the United States, when we are in a position where we start from being a smaller economy,
yes,
but we also start from being an economy that is desperate to link ourselves up with new trading
That's right.
partners.
Yeah.
We're not going to get a good deal, and we're not going to get it quickly.
Yeah, very good points, absolutely. So I'm not sure how many people have really given that thought at a political level, but you're absolutely right. You know, we're potentially not in a position of strength. And obviously, when you're negotiating and you deal with someone else, if you're coming from a lower base, then that's going to be a harder task. I like the idea, at least, of still being able to get some fresh fish. I definitely need to improve my diet. So if I can get fish from the Faroe Islands, then that's going to be good for me personally.
It's a start.
Exactly. From your research into the potential consequences of Brexit, how do you think, we've talked about some of the short-term implications around the supply chain, how do you think leaving the EU might impact the high street in the longer term? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, it really depends on whether we get a deal, and if we get a deal, what sort of deal we get. So the conversation that we've just been having is about a scenario of no deal, there's a cliff edge.
Mm.
We get into very significant difficulties in the immediate term straight
yeah.
away. If we are in that scenario, in that sort of no-deal scenario, as I say, it's very difficult to predict how things will affect the high street.
Mm.
I think it will take a lot of time to adjust. I think you'll see significant disruptions in supply chains, and you'll see significant impacts on consumer spending power. You'll see significant impacts on consumer behaviour and all sorts of second-order impacts.
Sure.
If we're in a world where we get some sort of deal that is not a million miles away from the Prime Minister's. And as we know, the Prime Minister is trying to get her withdrawal agreement through the House. That changes things, but it doesn't change things dramatically. We enter into a world where there will be more checks at the border. There will be disruption. The UK border force is going to have a hard time making sure that things flow smoothly at Dover and other points of entry.
Yeah.
But we're not talking about something that feels like a drop-dead cliff-edge disaster. We're talking about something where there will be disruption to business, but it will be manageable disruption.
Right. So potentially impacting the flow of goods, the time it takes you to get your goods, the presumably the profitability, because the more checkpoints that you have, the more paperwork you have to fill out, the more bureaucracy you have to go through, ultimately that, particularly the more people that touches in an organisation.
Absolutely.
Then not only does it have an impact on time to market, but also on the cost of
absolutely
goods as well.
And obviously, if we're in a world, or which we are, of just-in-time supply chains, that disruption can, you know, it sounds small. I've got to wait an extra 6 hours at Dover or 10 hours or whatever it is. But in a world of just-in-time supply chains, that is potentially highly disruptive.
Yeah.
So we're already seeing major manufacturers getting ready, stockpiling components, etc. That's a very sensible thing to do. But that's something that tides you over for a few months. Mm. When we, let's say we have the Prime Minister's withdrawal agreement, there's some bumps in the road, but you know, we get to the middle of the year and things still feel okay. I actually think it's at that point later in the year that you start to see some of the longer term latent effects of this disruption to supply chains really kicking in. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen this discussion about Nissan in Sunderland, but if you're Nissan, if you're Ford in Dagenham, how are you going to be thinking about these things medium long term? The government is keen to make sure that major employers, major manufacturers are supported in the near term, but it's that longer term picture that I think is equally important.
You also talked about consumer confidence, which I think is a key point. So you see that being affected in the longer term as well. I think it's fair to say that it's had quite a big impact on trade over the last few months, probably the last year or two, really, since the Brexit vote.
Yeah,
consumer confidence seems to be eroding, and obviously, for the last 6 months, maybe longer, we've been in this holding pattern of not knowing what the heck was going to happen. And therefore, you know, why would you go out and buy a new car or make any, you know, spend big on any big ticket items when you really don't know what the implications of Brexit are going to be? And there's so much scaremongering around it.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's interesting to think through the timing elements of all of this. So when I was at The Economist, as you mentioned before, that I was at The Economist at the time of the vote, and my team did a piece of analysis that said, look, you know, this will be really serious for the UK. The economy will decline 6% compared to baseline. The pound will go down to 124. We'll have all of these near-term impacts. And a lot of that happened, but a lot of it, and particularly what we were saying around consumer behaviour, didn't actually happen at the time, because it hadn't sort of flown through in terms of how people thought about Brexit. Yeah. So we had a year, 18 months, getting on for 2 years after the vote, where consumer confidence actually held up reasonably well. The economy's held up reasonably well compared to some of the doom-mongering stories that I and my colleagues are putting out there.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that people haven't felt it yet. And I would go to these talks and events, and people would say to me, look, you know, Alex, you made all these ridiculous predictions about the effect on the economy, and none of it's happened, and you should be ashamed of yourself. And part of the excuse is obviously researchers never get things right.
Sure. Well, you don't have a crystal ball, right? You've done your best with the date. And again, you know, you are talking about a once-in-a-lifetime scenario that you will not have been through before. So
absolutely. But the core point is a timing point. I think that the economic effects of Brexit will be very serious. But for the average consumer, you know, 52% of people voted for this. They're not people who think that the economic effects are going to be desperately serious. The consumer was continuing to behave like everything was fine for the 2 years after the vote. I think what's starting to happen now, and what you saw around Christmas, for example, is the reality is finally dawning on people. It's in the news every day. Employers are shutting up shop every day. You know, we can talk about BMI, for example. It's finally starting to have that impact because it's about to happen. And to go back to the analysis that we put out 2 years ago, I think we were right. I think that all we got wrong was the timing, because consumers stayed, from my perspective, too confident for too long, given what was coming down the line.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. We talked about product earlier with regards to fresh food, etc. What do you think are the immediate changes that we might see in our stores? What goods rely on strong trade plans with Europe? And what might the implications be there?
It's a very good question. I mean, the point to make is that, you know, we've been part of this single market with Europe for a generation. This economy, the UK economy, is deeply, deeply intertwined with the economies of the rest of Europe. So the changes are unpredictable. It's a little bit like saying, you know, if California was suddenly no longer part of the US, what are you going to stop seeing in stores in California?
Yeah.
I think there are a few sort of general points to make. One, certainly for any perishable products, so that's, you know, food, but also flowers, this sort of thing, you're going to need to see much greater localism, simply because, you know, you can't have your baguettes sitting in the Channel Tunnel and not moving. You're going to see greater focus on local production.
Is that not a good thing, to some extent?
Yes. Certainly there are individual businesses that will
benefit.
Take advantage of that. But in a theoretical sense, you know, if we are currently importing our baguettes from France, I'm not saying that we are, but if we're importing our baguettes from France, that's because they're either higher quality or lower cost. And if we're replacing them with baguettes from Yorkshire, they may be delicious, but there's a reason why we're not doing that at the moment.
Just like to point out that Alex is actually from Yorkshire, okay?
I'm not picking on
Yorkshire. I think you're well qualified to comment on that. So I think we've touched on some of the products and some of the implications there. What other industries do you think might be affected the most by Brexit?
Anything where there's strong interlinkage with the continent. So we talked about manufacturing. Some of our service industries are going to be deeply affected as well. So financial services, which makes up 12 or 13% of the economy. We're not going to see the export of financial and legal services to quite the same extent that we have in the past.
What do you mean by that?
The UK hosts Europe's deepest and richest capital market. Mm-hmm. Over time, we're going to see a significant migration of those services to other centres in Europe.
Like Frankfurt, for example.
Well, interestingly, the businesses that I speak to, it's mostly Amsterdam and Dublin that are benefiting. Mm-hmm. But you're going to see an ongoing migration of those sorts of very high value add jobs that come with high wage packets and high personal tax contributions. Mm-hmm. I think in the area of services, it's not so much, you know, fire everybody in London, hire 10,000 people in Dublin. It's the incremental investment as you build out new products and services. You don't put those in a country where you have difficulties of access and where you need to go and get your legal forms in triplicate and there's uncertainty. You go and put them in Dublin or you go and put them in Amsterdam. I think that applies across the services sector. I think let's go back to our scenarios. Obviously, if we're in a no-deal scenario, then all bets are off and things could be very serious very quickly. If we're in a withdrawal agreement scenario, where there are arrangements like the Prime Minister and the government are trying to put in place, it could be that we find that the immediate term impacts are not quite as serious as we feared, but the medium long term impacts are significantly worse because it's your incremental investment that doesn't go into putting a trading floor in London, it goes into putting a trading floor in Amsterdam, that doesn't go into building a new car plant in Sunderland, it goes into building a new car plant in Katowice in Poland.
And of course, all of that has a direct impact on the consumer, because when that car plant is moved away from Sunderland to another European country or part of the EU, that means fewer opportunities, fewer jobs, potential loss of jobs moving forward as well.
Yeah.
That trickles down into the local economy, people with less disposable income, and so on and so forth. So there's a bit of a vicious cycle there.
Yeah, and it's worth thinking about the regional implications of some of this. So not everybody will be affected equally. So there are particular parts of the country that will be much more seriously affected. London actually is not expected to be the worst hit. You're talking about places with close economic linkages to the continent, so parts of the southeast outside of London, Northern Ireland, and there's all the Irish specific issues there.
Sure.
But really, particular parts of the country are certainly going to be hit worse than others. So the impact on the high street is not going to be uniform.
No, and ironically, some of those localities outside of London, outside of the main conurbations, would be some of the areas probably that voted to leave in the first place.
Yeah.
But of course, without the knowledge of what might be coming further down the track. Just on that note about the high street, what do you think we'll see changing in the way British people shop and what they buy as a result of Brexit? Do you see anything fundamental changing there? You talked about local produce.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question.
Let me prompt that a little bit further, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So I'm sitting here thinking, and I really don't know the answer to this, but I was just wondering whether or not, and I'm not trying to help this scenario, but I was just wondering whether or not, for example, H&M and, you know, a bunch of international brands that now take up space on most of our high streets, whether or not there might be some form of consumer backlash against international businesses post-Brexit in any shape or form?
It's a very good question. Obviously, that links to what's going on in our politics a little bit more broadly, and it links to how the process of Brexit is completed. I mean, it's, you know, there are a range of political outlooks out there. There are clearly some people for whom this is a moment at which to protest foreign brands, foreign countries, things that are non-British. Mm. So you could see that expressed in consumer behaviour. Mm. It could affect some of the companies that you mentioned. I would tend to take a more optimistic view of British social and cultural attitudes than that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the debate about Britain's role in Europe and Britain's role in the world will continue.
Yeah.
Brexit, we often talk about as though it's an end point, and then we all sort of clap our hands and go, right, we're done, move on to the next issue. Mm. Sadly, I regret to tell your listeners, that's not going to be the case. The nature of the relationship with Europe is always going to be up for debate.
Mm.
And within that, the extent to which we are shopping for foreign products, shopping for European goods and services, will be part of how that is expressed in the cultural and political debate.
Mm.
So I think you're right. There could well be a near-term hit to brands that have a particular association with different European countries.
Mm. Yeah.
I wouldn't personally necessarily expect that to be a lasting one.
No, definitely not. Just on that note then, I wonder, because you talked about, you know, the possible opportunity for local producers to benefit, some local producers to benefit as a result of Brexit, due to the fact that certain goods or services might not be, that we may have imported, may not be readily available now. I just wonder if you think there's an opportunity here. I'm a very strong advocate of the high street.
Yeah.
And I fly a little bit in the face of a lot of the negativity around the high street and the fact that the high street's dying, which I genuinely don't believe to be the case. I think it's evolving.
Yeah.
You know, I think the reality is today we still essentially make 80% of our retail purchases in a physical environment and not in an online environment.
Yeah.
But I think it has to evolve. And I'm just wondering whether or not the opportunity, you know, the kind of localization opportunity and Brexit to some extent might actually encourage people back to the high street, might encourage them to support, you know, local retailers, independent retailers, as well as the nationals, and maybe get out there and you know, experience physical retail as well as buying online.
Yeah,
any thoughts on that?
I think that's a really interesting thought, and you could well be proved to be right. I mean, I agree with you fundamentally. The high street is a physical location where people meet and they engage with the real world, and they have a real world lived experience. And it's, you know, you can have as much sort of consumer efficiency benefit from online as you like, but people still want that proper real world engagement.
Mm.
And you could well be right that we're certainly going to be entering a period of significant change in the way that people get access to goods and services and consume them and everything else. Brexit will lead to that, whether it's done through a dramatic cliff edge or not. It's certainly going to lead to some changes in behaviour and changes in supply chains. And it's a not unreasonable thesis, I think, Martin, that you know, that could lead to some changes that we're not expecting. It could lead to more localism. It could lead to more community-focused businesses doing quite well.
That's an instinct I have. Just a thought around that. So we shall see how it plays out.
Yeah.
If you were having a conversation with our politicians right now that are responsible for negotiating Brexit, if they want to support the retail economy, what would you be asking them to prioritise?
I would be asking them to prioritise certainty. Now, that's a bit of a sort of catch-all phrase, but the fact that politicians really miss about what the business community needs is a sense of predictability and certainty about what's going on. People can adapt if they know which way the wind is blowing and where it's going to take us. Yep. What we're really suffering from at the moment is a sense that we simply don't know. We don't know whether we're about to jump off a cliff. We don't know how steep the cliff is. We don't know what's at the bottom of it. We don't know whether we're going to get a negotiated settlement or not. We don't know what's going to happen to our supply chains. We don't know what's going to happen at borders. The sooner that retail businesses have a sense of where this is all going, what they can rely on, what they can do what they do best, which is actually engage in a proper, sensible corporate strategy and plan around it. And I think that's what politicians are missing. Yes, the end state is important, but the certainty about the end state and how we're going to get there and what we're going to do along the way is really, really important as well. So I would be encouraging politicians to provide as much clarity as possible as soon as possible.
It sounds like there's been a serious lack of scenario planning, doesn't it? I mean, it's not as if we haven't known for quite a considerable period of time of what the high level, you know, potential scenarios would be, i.e. Brexit. Yes, we don't know what the negotiated deal, well, we do know what the negotiated deal has been so far.
Yeah.
So we could have done some scenario planning around that. We could have done some scenario planning around, you know, the cliff edge nightmare, no deal Brexit.
Yeah.
And we could have planned that and scenarioed that, I guess, with a number of different hypotheses from good to extreme, well, not good, but, you know, worst case scenario to a complete disaster.
Yeah.
It just feels like there's been a lack of that, because if there had been more process and more, you know, thinking and planning around that, surely we could have provided that to businesses and given them a better indication of at least what the options were, and then they could decide what to plan for and what not to plan for.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair comment. I think just as a way of sort of illustrating this, I spend quite a lot of time talking to officials in government, and you come across so many people who are spending literally all of their time thinking about Brexit planning. Mm-hmm. So the government has 320 different work streams across 20 different departments. The civil service is taking this extremely seriously. Mm-hmm. But there are two or three things that make that really difficult. The first is it's really fantastically complicated to disentangle this big institutional arrangement that we have with the EU. It affects every area of national life, every area of the economy. It's just, frankly, really darn difficult. Mm. That's number one. Number two, we have a government and an opposition who are deeply split in both cases about what they want to do. And we have a population that is deeply split down the middle about whether they want to go through with this process or not. So, you know, it's a common criticism of politicians to say that they are disingenuous or, you know, not necessarily being fully honest and open. And I can understand that frustration. But frankly, I think our political system and our politicians are trying to reconcile some really quite irreconcilable views about the nature of our relationship with Europe and the nature of the economic structure that we want for this country. And they are grappling with that, and they are not finding it easy.
Sure.
And, you know, one might have more sympathy for some individuals than others, but fundamentally the political system is trying to grapple with something that is very, very deeply difficult indeed.
I understand that. I really do. I mean, this is clearly, you know, an incredibly complicated and complex issue generally right across the board. I suppose that the one thing my instinct tells me is that in the early days and thinking about, you know, how do we tackle this and what might we need to be doing, that it feels like it's been a bit of a miss. I mean, to your point, you know, because you made the point about that lack of, you know, that uncertainty and lack of certainty.
Yeah.
And whilst we can't be certain, we could provide maybe more around, what the potential implications could be, and therefore as a business owner, what you should be thinking about. And, you know, there's option A, there's option B, there's option C, there's option D, and you might not be able to do all four.
Yeah.
But you can place your bets and you can decide which way you think we're going to go. And, you know, you can at least decide what you do about resources, about people, about processes. You know, if you're selling, you know, if you're selling goods or you're exporting, what the implications are going to be for you. And that, you know, that uncertainty, I feel, has had a pretty significant impact on businesses, and you know,
completely
just
agree.
Drives stagnation, doesn't it?
Completely agree, and you know, you're seeing it now in the economic data, and you know, you're absolutely right. And I shouldn't. This is not sort of to defend the UK's current crop of politicians. It's just, you know, we've been dealt quite a difficult hand by the public.
Yeah.
And it is unsurprising from a long-term perspective that we're in a period of great uncertainty.
Mm.
It is the job of politicians and officials to get us out of that, to deliver as much certainty as possible, to deliver the best possible outcome so that we can get on and hopefully without too much damage, all of us get on with our lives,
yes.
Quite frankly.
I think we'd all like to do that. That's for sure. Just on that note, and I'm putting you a little bit on the spot here, and this is, I suppose, partly a gut instinct and partly from, you know, somebody with your background and your insight into what's happening around Brexit. If, you know, and I'm not suggesting that I think there will be a people's vote or whatever you want to call it, because I feel that boat sailed, and I'm sure we're going to end up with, you know, a deal of some description, or at least I hope we will, so we can just get on with our lives. But, you know, if ultimately we had a vote again tomorrow, do you feel that, you know, given what the public know now, do you think there would be a different outcome, or do you think it would be the same?
I do, yes. I think that we would likely vote narrowly to stay.
Yeah.
If you look at the trajectory of the polling, it's all heading in that direction.
Yeah.
But it would be very close. I mean, there's a couple of factors at play. One, you know, you can have a bit of buyer's remorse, and voters can look at the situation and say, actually, this isn't what we expected, and the economic implications may be more serious. But individuals don't like to admit that they're wrong, especially about something quite so major. So there's a sort of political sunk cost fallacy that comes into play. People will say, you know, no, we weren't wrong. It's the politicians and the officials messing everything up, and let's continue. So I think it would be close. I mean, if you push me on it, I'd say if we were to vote again, you'd probably have the same result, but the other way around,
yes,
sort of 52-48 to stay.
Yeah, that's my instinct as well. I mean, I do think, you know, that irrespective of how you, which side of the fence that you were on initially, I think the fact that, you know, all this talk about being undemocratic by having another vote, you know, in my mind eye, it's almost the opposite.
Mm.
It's the fact you've put something to the people and the people voted with very limited information.
Absolutely.
Now they have all the not all the information, but they at least have
more information. Yeah.
Still a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And that's also part of the challenge. But, you know, why wouldn't you then at that point take it back and give people, you know, another say and say, well, do you still feel the same or do you not feel the same?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, here's the deal. This is what it is. Take it or leave it.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
An attractive option.
I doubt very much I'm going to have any great influence on what happens as far as that's concerned.
Maybe somebody will be listening to this podcast and
Who knows? I doubt it, but you never know. Are there any upsides? We've kind of touched on one or two things, but just wondering whether you feel there are upsides to leaving the EU for the British economy. As an economist, what would you say?
Well, you have to aim off a little bit for my own personal views, which are that this is, you know, that Brexit's a bad idea, it's bad for the UK and we shouldn't be doing it. So that's my starting point.
You really do beat around the bush, don't you?
But look, any time that you have a major structural change in the way that an economy works, even if the net impact is very negative, we're effectively throwing all the cards up in the air in terms of the components of the British economy. They will land in a different place. Some people will benefit from that. So we talked about some sort of small examples earlier on. You know, there might be more focus on localism, both in terms of fresh produce, but also in terms of, you know, other kinds of consumer businesses. So there will be some beneficiaries. I think that's undoubtable.
Yeah.
But net, I think the overall economic impact and the overall impact on consumers, we're going to be worse off. Yeah.
Yeah. Then that'll come back in the long term at some point in time. Once we've eventually managed to do some meaningful trade deals.
No, look, you know, I believe in free trade. The EU fundamentally at heart is a trading bloc. It's the world's deepest and most successful trading bloc, made up of most of the world's wealthy countries who are all our neighbours and our close trading partners. We are choosing to exit that bloc. I personally think it would be very hard to make the case that that's not going to be anything other than negative, both in the near term and the long term. Yeah. The more that you put in the way of trade and businesses getting on and running their business, the less economic welfare you have as a result.
Thank you for that. What would your advice be for anyone who's concerned about Brexit and Britain's retail industry? What would you say to them? So there's a lot of people there right now pretty damn concerned about how this is all going to play out.
Yeah.
What would you say to them?
Well, there's many things. It sort of depends who they're facing off against. I mean, I think that it's important for British businesses to try and provide their customers and their staff and their broader stakeholders with a sense of as much certainty and support as they can. People out there will be worried. There are lots of scare stories in the press. If I am a big British business, I want to make sure that I provide as much comfort, as I say, to my staff and to my consumers as possible. And that's important. And business needs to show some leadership in doing that. If you're facing off against politicians, civil servants, European partners, then I think it's important to be clear and honest and specific about what the impacts on your business and your employees and your consumers is going to be. It is relatively easy for politicians to brush off somebody like me saying, look, the impacts are going to be net negative. It's far harder for them to brush off a small business owner or the manager of a larger business coming in and saying, look, I'm going to have to lay off X number of people because of this. These are the direct impacts on me and my business and my employees. So I think they need to be doing that. The third thing that I would say is that they need to be engaging with their suppliers, contractors and other businesses with which they do business to make sure, number one, that their trading partners are doing the same thing. Number two, that they're prepared. Yeah, I think I'd sum it up with those three things.
Good advice, Alex. Thank you. Just given what you said at the very outset of the podcast, I know you can't give a black and white answer to this, but again, I'd love to know your perspective. What's your gut tell you? How's this going to play out? What's actually going to happen? What do you think?
I think that we'll see a delay. So I think that we will move until later in the year until we see the denouement. I think ultimately there has to be a deal, simply because the consequences of no deal are so very, very serious indeed. Now, you know, the Prime Minister is looking at the electoral implications for her party. There are obviously electoral implications if she splits her party by pushing through a withdrawal agreement with Labour Party support. But there are, I think, even more serious long-term electoral implications if she is in government and her party are in government when the British economy leaps off a cliff. So I think that will be in her mind and in the minds of parliamentarians as they consider this. So I think a deal eventually, but I also think, as I said earlier, the debate does not end. The debate about the nature of Britain's relationship with the EU continues. We probably have the People's Vote campaign transmogrifying into a rejoin campaign. And I think that we have this issue of the nature of our relationship with our core trading partners being a fundamental feature of British politics, perhaps for the next 10, 20 years. Now, that is very serious in terms of the reshaping of the British political scene. But it's also very serious for the types of businesses that we've been talking about in this podcast, because I don't think that we will have a certain settled relationship for the foreseeable future.
That's got to be concerning. We've talked primarily about the Brexit implications for retail. I mean, presumably, it's just dawning on me as I'm thinking about fresh produce and everything. There are some pretty calamitous potential impacts of a no-deal Brexit on food and beverage, on casual dining, which is a sector which has been arguably as affected, if not even more affected, by lack of consumer confidence and also changing consumer behaviour, you know, possibly over the last couple of years. But, you know, the implications for restaurants if they can't get fresh produce.
Well, also access to labour.
Yeah, absolutely.
Be really serious. Totally. And it's very serious for the agricultural sector as well. I mean, it's interesting that you hear behind the scenes that one of the ministers who's been most concerned about a no-deal Brexit is Michael Gove, the Environment Secretary. Mm-hmm. Now, Gove, as you know, was a big Brexit proponent, but he's had a lot of people going in to see him talking about what the implications are for British agriculture, food and beverages, etc., etc. And he's, you know, he's somebody who has listened to some of that. So he still wants to see Brexit, but he's one of the most ardent opponents of a no deal. And that, I think that reinforces the point that I was making earlier, the advice that I was giving, that companies really do need to go in, see the relevant politician, and make their points as granular and as specific and as pertinent as they can. Mm. And if you're talking to somebody sensible, you'll see a response.
Mm. Well, I'll be honest with you. My instinct is we will leave. I don't think there will be a people's vote. I think you made some great points there. And I don't know whether I'll be around long enough or live long enough to see what I think will be the ultimate outcome, but I actually do think we'll end up rejoining. And I think that hopefully will happen in my lifetime. But if not, watch this space. I hope you've enjoyed it. My name is Martin Newman. That was my first podcast on Consumer Focus. Please join me again in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much to this week's guest, Alex White. I think he's brought a really great level of insight into what is an incredibly complex subject in Brexit. So thank you, Alex.
Thanks for having me, Martin.
My pleasure. So hope you all enjoy that and look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you very much.